Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am so sorry I wasn't able to contact anybody in time, but, well, you know, these things happen. But whatever the case may be, this is the very last day of American History Month. It's a little bit more than Black history, because we're all Americans. We're one, just like Michael said. So this is the very last day of our February History Month. And I want to spend a little time just loving up on Michael, you know. And so this broadcast is devoted to Michael Jackson. What it is it's about who he was, but more than that, it's about who we are now, having been in his presence. You know, Michael spoke to us saying, when all life is seen as divine, everyone grows wings. And Michael saw the divinity in us. Namaste, the God in me sees the God in you. And see, we saw not just the God, we saw the glory in Michael. And if you can, and if you will, go with me to Titus, chapter 2, verse 11. Start there. And this is how it reads. For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that, denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world, looking for that blessed hope and the glorious appearing of Jesus Christ. And I declare that so much sounds like my
glory. One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory,
oh,
glory, glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh,
glory, glory, glory,
oh,
glory, glory.
Now the war is not over, victory is in won. I will fight on to the finish, and then when it's all done,
woman and child. Even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles. From dark roads, heroes, to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win a war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes, it will
know, I know that song is so appropriate, but just between you and I, you know, I just wanted to play it because I was so touched by that song. And I wanted you to think about this, that in the presence of Michael, we already have been in the presence of glory. There were people who were there when Jesus Christ was walking this earth, and they were in the presence of glory. But they never knew it because they never could understand glory. But we are here together because we do. Most of us, you know, we've been trained in doctrine and such. We've been trained to believe that if we look beyond Christ, then we're going to be cursed and we're going to just burn in hell. However, I want to bring you to Andrew Himes. And he decided to take his grandmother. He decided to take his grandmother, and she became the God in his life. I can't think of a better way to say it. That's what happened. She became that image of God. See, I do believe that God will present himself to us any way he chooses to. And if he chooses to present himself to us as a dancer, then he will. A singer, then he will. But God, he or she, has the power to do however or whatever he or she would like to do. Now, I want you to hear from Andrew, because he brought up some very... Listen to Andrew. Listen to what he has to say.
When I was 4 years old, as a little boy, I took Jesus into my heart. And for me, what that meant was it was all about the love of Jesus. It was about this glowing, wonderful figure in my life. In the 1950s and 60s, I grew up partly in the segregated South, in a fundamentalist family, in a fundamentalist church. And I came to have sharp, strong questions about what it meant to be a Christian, about what my faith was all about. And I began to identify my faith with social injustice, with racial injustice, with the violence of the war in Vietnam. My grandmother died in 1989, and then the time that she died was a moment of profound reflection and deep distress for me. I went back to Murfreesboro for her funeral, the Franklin Road Baptist Church, 1,000 people in the church for her funeral. And I'm convinced that every one of those 1,000 people thought of her as their very best friend in the world. My grandmother was the person in my life, I came to realize, the person in my life who represented unconditional love. So when she died, I got back on the airplane after her funeral, flew back to Seattle, and I was crying all the way. And people around me were patting me on the shoulder and commiserating with me. I'm sure they all thought I must be going through some profound nervous breakdown or a terrible emotional trauma. And I was. It was traumatic for me because she was the person who had represented love to me, and she was now dead. So I thought, what do I do with this terrible sadness? I decided that if there was one thing I could do, it would be to take my grandmother into my heart the same way that I'd taken Jesus into my heart as a little boy. If I can act as if I were my grandmother with everybody in my life, with my neighbors, my coworkers, my family members, my daughter, with strangers that I meet on the street, if I could do that, what difference would it make to me and to the world? So it was like, you know, I got to practice this. And my grandmother is someone who's continually a part of my memory, of my consciousness, and has really has helped me all these years after her death to live out her life in mine.
So you see, there's a lot that's Andrew Himes. He's saying a lot that I know we can understand And think about the wave of grief that went across this country when Michael left. And that's the kind of grief that I do believe that Andrew was talking about the hundreds of thousands of people that came for his grandmother, and how he was going to put his grandmother in his heart the way he had put Jesus there. Now, actually, I don't know if he put Jesus there or if, you know, throughout time, you know, he was taught that Jesus must be there, but I understand that God is love. And his grandmother was love, so he put his grandmother in his heart. And that's what we do with Michael. Put Michael in our heart, and if we could live the way he lived, if we could do things the way Michael did, if we could only, then how blessed we would be, and how many people would we a blessing to? Would we be a blessing to, rather? You know, Michael talked about seeing God. And see, when I listen to what Andrew was saying, I know that what has happened is he had a chance to glimpse God. He saw God, and God presented himself or herself as his grandmother. This is how Michael says it, and I do love this. It's strange that God doesn't mind expressing himself, herself, in all the religions of the world while people still cling to the notion that their way is the only right way. Whatever you try to say about God, someone will take offense, even if you say everyone's love of God is right for them. For me, the form of God takes, it's not the important thing. What's most important is the essence. My songs and dances are just outlines for him to come in and fill. I hold out the form, and she puts in the sweetness. I've looked up into the night sky and beheld the stars so intimately close. It was as if my grandmother had made them for me. How rich, how sumptuous, I thought. And in that moment, I saw God in his creation. I could as easily have seen her in the beauty of a rainbow, the grace of a deer bounding through a meadow, the truth of a father's kiss. But for me, the sweetest contact with God has no form. I close my eyes to look within and enter a deep silence. The infinity of God's creation embraces me. We are one. You know, the Bible says, let brotherly love continue. Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. I believe Michael was an angel. I do. Michael was an angel, but Michael was a black man, however. But that was just the color of his skin, you see. African Americans have suffered a lot of trials and tribulations based upon the color of their skin. The only saddening thing is that when people are focused on your skin, whether it's a black person focused on white skin or a white person focused on black skin, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. The thing is that while you're focused on the flesh, you miss the most beautiful thing, and that is the God in you or the person that you're seeing or talking to. And that's what Michael was saying. God has no form. You don't know. The color of a skin is something to identify. It has a form. But that's not the way it really is, and we need to understand that. So people were trained not to see the divinity in others, especially in black people. Now, you know and I know that you cannot train out divinity from someone. You cannot train someone to hate unless you've trained them to love. And I've said on other occasions that hate is not the matter of being evil. Hate is the rejection of love, okay? And you cannot reject it if you don't acknowledge it. And so we know, and even the haters know, that God is love, and they see that love in Michael. What do you do when someone's been telling you all your life, if you know what God's going to get you, God's going to do this and that to you because you've not been all that he wants you to be? Well, then one thing for sure is you don't want God in your presence. And so, as I see it regarding Michael, people worked hard to be out of his presence because they saw the God in him. And, you know, I know that, you know, you, there's someone out there saying, well, why isn't she playing some music? What is she doing talking so much? Well, I'm not a talky person, but you see, we cannot talk about Michael, of course, without talking about music. And, you know, we cannot talk about music without talking about soul. And we cannot talk about soul without talking about spirit. So that's why I'm running off at the mouth, and I hope you will bear with me. Michael was acutely aware of people who tried to take his soul. Now, I know that sounds a little bit strange, but there are people, Michael had people out that were imitating him. And I saw some people, they were not just imitating him. I do believe they wanted his soul. And I know that someone's got to understand what I'm talking about. There's a difference. There's an extraordinary difference when you see someone who's dancing, and when you, it's like that person that you knew growing up, that person who wanted everything you had, and they thought that that would make them into you or something to that effect, but it doesn't happen. God will have us as he has us. We do not go out and we don't create ourselves. This is the body, and we are one. But as to taking someone's soul out, I want to bring you to a scripture. And this is about the woman in the Bible that had the issue of blood. This is in Luke 8, starting at 43. And a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all of her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any, came behind him and touched the border of his garment. And immediately her issue of blood was staunched. And Jesus said, who touched me? Because, you know, he felt the spirit of, he felt something go out of him. And when everybody denied, Peter said, well, Master, the multitude throng thee and press thee and sayest thou, who touched me? Well, that's because you can have a million people following you, but you don't have a million people believing you. There are some people that are just traipsing along. This person saw the glory of Jesus, and she touched him so that she could receive some of that glory, and she did. She didn't even have to touch him. She touched the hem of his robe. And so they took a little bit away. You know, as I think about these things, sometimes I struggle with them. I struggle with the idea of, you know, someone taking your soul. Of course, you know, you'd have to be somebody that whose soul was worthy of. I think it's very difficult to hear him speaking. And that is Michael.
Like they always say, you know, they built a big house they spent a lot of money. They bought a lot of cars. That's stupid. That's an excuse. That's nothing compared to what artists make. And I just need you to know that this is very important, what we're fighting for. Because I'm tired. I'm really, really tired of the manipulation. I'm tired of how the press is manipulating everything that's been happening in this situation. They do not tell the truth. They're liars. And they manipulate our history books. The history books are not true. It's a lie. The history books are lying. You need to know that. You must know that. All the forms of popular music, from jazz to hip hop to bebop to soul, you know, to you talk about the different dances, from the cakewalk to the jitterbug to the Charleston to break dancing. All these are forms of black dancing. What's more important than giving people a sense of escapism? And escapism meaning entertainment. What would we be like without a song? Okay. What would we be like without a dance? Joy and laughter and music. These things are very important. But if you go to the bookstore down the corner, you won't see one black person on the cover. You'll see Elvis Presley. You see the Rolling Stones. But where are the real pioneers who started? Otis Blackwell was a prolific, phenomenal writer. He wrote some of the greatest Elvis Presley songs ever. This is a black man. It's time for a change. And listen to not leave this building and forget what has been said. Put it into your heart. Put it into your subconscious mind. And let's do something about it. We have to. We have to. Because it's been a long, long time coming. And a change has got to come. So let's hold our torches high and get the respect that we deserve. I love you.
Cover of these magazines. You won't see them being accredited for all that they have done. And that's
I think, what kind of like bothered Michael. Michael knew he didn't have to live with it forever, but he knew that we would have to cope with this. And I'm going to try to get this and play it for us.
Oh, my.
Not you, Mary, John, and Bob. These are kids from other schools. And did you know in some states it used to be against the law to teach blacks to read or write? Nowadays we're getting these integrated schoolrooms, and most people think that if we get enough teaching and enough jobs, everything is going to take care of itself. But there is a scar of history running right through kids as young as these. It tears you up if you know how to look at drawings kids make, because kids shouldn't know much about history and anything about discrimination. I mean, nobody hates little black kids, but why do some of them cause so much trouble? And if you ask black and white children to draw themselves or trees or houses, some strange things happen. We ask some ordinary white kids from ordinary families to make some drawings for us. Like, well, let's call him John. John's white, and we asked him to draw himself. This is John. This is his house, and this is his tree. Then we ask the black kid, let's call him Ralph, to do the same thing. This is Ralph's drawing of himself. This is his tree. Now, why should two kids of the same age draw so differently? Enter the expert. This is Dr. Emanuel Hammer, psychiatrist specializing in children's therapy.
Let me illustrate it for you. Let's take these drawings. No matter what a child draws, he's really picturing himself. Ask a secure child to draw a tree, and he's likely to draw a bountiful, spreading tree. A black child drew this tree, cut off in its growth, stark, bare, ungratified. It works the same way with drawings of people. Normal children, average drawings. The mood is happy, the child feels capable, the drawings are complete, and the arms are developed to emphasize strength. These children were old enough to draw complete figures. The significant fact is what they left out: arms, hands. A child may sense that a situation in life is so powerless that he himself is equivalent to an armless man. My own study reveals that armless people appear 3 times more frequently in the drawings by black children than those by white. The faceless being suggests that these youngsters not only feel themselves to be less than they might be, they don't even feel themselves to be. The black child who is forced to live in a hostile world may disappear in self-defense. He drifts through life feeling like a shadow. He stops caring and he stops trying. A child who has this on his mind cannot be a child. A child who has this on his mind could want to burn down cities when he gets older.
The whole confusion was summed up by a black 9-year-old in these two paintings. This is a 9-year-old boy draws a white man, Robin Hood maybe. And this is how the same boy draws himself. And this is the consequence of deformed history.
Linda, close the curtains. Brian, lower the screen. Bonnie, light please.
In the past 50 years, 33,000 feature films have been made in the United States, and about 6,000 of them have had parts for black actors. For the most part, the black portraits have been drawn by white writers, white producers, and white directors for a white audience. Most black parts were the way white Americans wanted them to be. The black male was consistently shown as nobody, nothing. He had no qualities that could be admired by any man, or more particularly, any woman.
Well, the sun goes down, the tide goes down, the dark gather around them, they all begin to shout. Hey, hey, Uncle Dusty and Speed.
White people didn't like to think much about them, sort of like a relative you got in a rest home. Being happy darkies, dancing and singing was all they wanted to hear about. Being good Christians, the whites out front like to think the blacks out back were kind of happy. Uncle Tom's Cabin was one of the first movies made that tried to say anything about black people. Uncle Tom was changed a little each time it was put on the stage, and all the parts were played by white actors. And by the time they made a movie of it in 1903, Uncle Tom was just the white man's idea of a good nigger.
Uncle Tom,
You might say he was what H. Rep. Brown ate. They made this picture 5 times. By the time they finished with it, Mickey Rooney could have played Uncle Tom. Pistol shows started as the black man's entertainment for himself and the plantation owners. When they were filmed, though, they were done by a white cast. You can figure that out. They were done as sort of a joke, and the black entertainer couldn't even get a job making fun of himself. The first really vicious anti-Negro film was called The Birth of a Nation, and it was a honey. The second worst thing about it was that technically, in 1918, it was the best movie that had ever been made. A cat named D.W. Griffith produced it, and he knew how. See? Birth of a Nation pretended to tell the story of the Civil War and what happened afterwards when the slaves were freed. The white woman couldn't walk on her own sidewalk, if you believe the picture. In the South, Negroes got the right to vote. The movie showed black vote collectors refusing to accept white votes and black people sneaking in extra votes. Black bad guys don't look very bad to you. It's probably because they were white actors wearing burnt cork. Negro legislators took over in the South, and in the film they were made to look like apes. And this was the movie version of how it looked in the Southern state legislature. They drank whiskey. They ate chicken with their hands in the state house. And they put their feet up on the table with their shoes off. And of course they passed all sorts of crazy laws according to the film. Like anybody could marry anybody they wanted to. It was obvious to anyone who saw this picture that Negroes weren't fit to govern themselves or anyone else because they really weren't people. This film is 50 years old, and it may look silly and out of date now, but it didn't look silly when it was made seen. Several million Americans who saw it were propagandized to believe that this is the way things would be if they weren't careful. So they've been pretty careful. Colonel Cameron, a former officer in the Confederate Army, is all upset over the way Northerners and the freed slaves are changing his South, taking a mint julep right out of his mouth. So he takes a walk one day while he's worrying about it, and he sees 2 white kids playing, and then 4 black kids come along. Being hardly human and naturally afraid of ghosts, the black kids run. Colonel Cameron sees the whole scene, gets his great idea. And with this, that great white all-American organization, the KKK, was born. The cavalry and the bedsheet has come to the rescue. The South is saved. In this picture, the Ku Klux Klan was the good boy who saved the South. Most Hollywood films, though, even the early ones, weren't really nasty. Nobody was sitting around saying, hey, let's take care of the niggas. What producers were doing was making money. And to make money, they made pictures that white ticket buyers would enjoy. They showed Negroes the way most Americans like to think of them. To blame Hollywood is like throwing a rock at the mirror because you don't like what you see in it. Burt Williams was one of the great vaudeville performers. He couldn't get parts in white pictures, so he made a lot of short comedies. He played the part most Americans consider typical Negro. It wasn't bad, really, just lazy, stupid, and happy the way he was, and his feet hurt. He was afraid of most everything. When he was scared, he shook, and his teeth chattered. Unlike a scared white man, the black man's eyes could pop out of his head. When he was scared, he was so scared he couldn't talk. He was also so scared he couldn't run. They stood like a rock on the face of things that scared black men. Another strange physical characteristic was when they were really very scared, the guys turned white. back on these old films, the patterns come jumping out at you. The most consistent thing about them was the attack on the black man. He was never even given the privilege of being a man. He was a boy, as in, you know, here boy. They had a lot of other great qualities besides being cowardly. For instance, they stole chickens.
Who's in there?
And we're going to stop that right there. It's pretty long. It's pretty long, but I think that we get the point. And as that progresses, then Bill Cosby talks about, and I must apologize for his language, really, but I think that, you know, the content of what he was saying, you know, kind of supersedes that one word. We don't believe it. We don't have those feelings toward each other. And I hope that you know, you could see it like that. Anyway, the thing is that those pictures, you know, watching those movies back in the day, what it did is it put a picture of what black men were like. It just pressed it into the brain, and I've never really quite understood why no one could even understand it. Even most recently, those terrible pictures that were being drawn of the Prophet Muhammad. And people said, well, we've got freedom of speech. We can draw whatever we want. But a picture stays in your mind, and people will come to believe it. So if you draw a picture of the Prophet Muhammad dancing around naked someplace, doing something vile, then that's the thing that people will have in their mind. And likewise, those movies that showed, you know, step and fetch it and things. You know, this person had hurt feet. You know, I know everybody's heard that expression, feet don't fail me now, and all that. So what Michael thought about it is you can't let somebody make your history for you. You've got to make your history yourself. You've got to go and define yourself before someone else defines you.
in the history of our nation.
Some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
One of the things that I know that Michael saw, and why it's so important for us to have that history, for us to make our mark on this world, in this world, why it's so important for us to say who we are, is because God has said who we are in the first place. The only thing that we have to do is be who we already are. But if you come into a situation where people are treating you like you're less than you are, or calling you, making it seem like you're less than you are. You follow me. You know that you know what I'm saying. I'm trying to be nice about it, actually. But there are people who will do everything in their power to subject you to degradation. And that's just the way it is. It is up to us. It is up to us to understand that we are as God called us to be. And again, this is the body. There is nothing that is not beautiful about us. We cannot have the parts that are unspoken of being upset because they're not a part that is fanfare. This is the body. We all need each other. We're all one together. And if we can understand that, then things will be better. So this is a spirit that has been transferred. These people, many of the people today, someone might say, well, look, that guy is racist. He's really not. It's been, this is what I believe. I do not believe these people are racist. I believe it's been bred in them, and that's what they believe. That's who they are. You know what I mean? It's been pressed into their brains. It is not as though these people, just like, you know, nobody wakes up and says, gee, I think I'll go out there and lynch a black man. That's not true. But people are trained to think that way. Have a listen. I want you to listen to a little more of Andrew. Andrew was from a famous black church. I mean, I'm sorry, a famous fundamental church. And, well, let's have a listen to him.
Well, 1963 was an incredible year. It was the year when the civil rights movement was just spreading like wildfire across the South. I lived in Millington, Tennessee, and it was right in the middle of the Mid-South. And earlier that summer, Medgar Evers, a civil rights leader, had just been gunned down in his driveway about 50 miles south of my front doorstep. A few weeks earlier in September, four little girls were killed in a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, by a bomb set off by the Ku Klux Klan. And on a Sunday morning, four sailors walked into my church, the Southside Baptist Church in Millington, right next to the Naval Air Station. Three of them were white, one was black. And when they walked in the door, every single member of the Board of Deacons, all of their family members, and most of the people sitting in the church that morning walked out the door rather than sit in a church on Sunday morning with a black man. And I think that was the beginning of my questioning about just what was Christianity all about. If Christians could act in that way on the side of what was clearly injustice, even I knew that it was wrong to treat people like that or react to people like that. If Christians could act that way, what was Christianity all about?
Now, there's something to think about. I'm sure that his family was a little taken aback for him to look at life this way, you know? He's from a very famous family of Baptist fundamentalists. And while we're speaking about Baptists, originally, Catherine, Michael's mom, she was a Baptist. But something happened and she became she was very unhappy with what the Baptist church was doing. I don't know. I have no idea because who can say? I don't. But she left, and that's when she became a Jehovah Witness. So, you know, there's an incredible spiritual element to the things that to discrimination and all that. You know, even with the Jehovah Witnesses, there are only 144,000 who are going to be able to sit at the right hand of God. And so if you have anything on your mind, you'll be trying to be one of the 144,000. But have a listen to this. We're still listening to Andrew, and this is an idea of what the church was like.
Well, 1963 was an incredible year. It was the year when the civil rights movement was just spreading like wildfire across the South. I lived in Millington, Tennessee, and it was right in the middle of the Mid-South. And earlier that summer, Medgar Evers, a civil rights leader, had just been gunned down in his driveway about 50 miles south of my front doorstep. A few weeks earlier in September, four little girls were killed in a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, by a bomb set off by the Ku Klux Klan. And on a Sunday morning, four sailors walked into my church, the Southside Baptist Church in Millington, right next to the Naval Air Station. Three of them were white, one was black. And when they walked in the door, every single member of the Board of Deacons, all of their family members, and most of the people sitting in the church that morning walked out the door rather than sit in a church on Sunday morning with a black man. And I think that was the beginning of my questioning about just what was Christianity all about. If Christians could act in that way on the side of what was clearly...
Now, I know that... I played the wrong message for you, so I'm going to get you the message that I want you to hear right now. Things as they are, you know, as things are, you know, I didn't stop that because I wanted you to hear one more time. This was the church, and there's a person who walks in. The person is black, and the entire church walks out. They would give up being in the sanctuary of God rather than be in the presence of a black man. And what I want you to see also coming up now is that this is not something that they just immediately did. This is trained into them from the time that they were children.
1963 in Millington, Tennessee, I was attending eighth grade at the Millington Central High School. And on an October morning, two black children walked into the school, a boy and a girl. They were met with a race riot. I remember standing in the hallway outside of my English class, and a couple of hundred kids from my school were between me and the other side of the hall where the black children were, and they were screaming curses and calling names and throwing things. Boys from my class were walking into the bathroom, coming out with little baggies full of urine and throwing them at the children. And I remember standing on the other side of the hall, just sobbing uncontrollably. I was horrified by what I saw happening, but I was even more horrified that I did nothing to stop it. I thought of myself as a complete moral coward, that I didn't have the courage to stand with those black children on that morning. And that was a shock to my system, and it led me in later years to want to devote myself to working for justice in the world and just to standing with children who were who just wanted an education, who just wanted a life like the one that I had.
Can you hear Michael in him? Can you hear Michael? Can you hear him crying about the children? Can you hear him being concerned about social justice? It's most amazing, and that is why I say we're cells in the body of God, in the body of love. That's because, you know, like you, we may be one member. That member may be your arm, but your arm is composed of millions and millions and millions of cells. And so though they are alike, and we will never know why, but I do know this. He was upset about not standing up. We needed people like Tom Meserol to stand up. We have to stand up against the lies. And we know that Michael stood up for everyone. He even went to the people to teach them about love. He went directly to the people. But let's hear Tom, because Tom stood up for him when everybody else had something to say.
Because I also learned that most people in that community thought the DA was on a vendetta to get Michael Jackson. He had convened a grand jury in the early 90s to try and get an indictment, and he had failed. The grand jury met for approximately 6 months and would not charge Michael Jackson with anything. And I have since spoken to someone who was on that grand jury quite recently from Los Angeles. She was on a Los Angeles grand jury that was convened at the same time, and they had real problems with these accusations. And real problems with a sense that people were trying to get money out of Michael Jackson by generating these charges. So he failed to get an indictment in the early 90s. In the mid-90s, the district attorney flew to Australia and Canada. They're the only countries I know that he went to. He may have gone to others, looking for victims of Michael Jackson. He failed. They told him to get lost. He didn't do anything to us. He had a website at the Sheriff's Department looking for information on Michael Jackson. And finally, got the case that you know about because it was tried this year. And as Professor Ogletree said, 10 felony counts, not guilty, 4 lesser included misdemeanor counts, not guilty. Didn't even hang him on misdemeanors. The case, in my opinion, was a total fraud. It was an effort by unscrupulous prosecutors and police to do anything they could and say anything they could say to try and get a conviction on a single count. And it was absolutely unjust what was done to Michael Jackson this year. But my conclusion on the issue of race, I told people who I had the ability to talk to about the issue the following. I said, to African-American people, Michael Jackson is black. He is black. If you ask him what his race is, he's black. But you know, to a lot of white people, Michael Jackson transcends race. He brings people together. We played tapes to the jury where he talked about why he loves people on all continents, people of all races. And I am absolutely convinced that that jury saw Michael Jackson as someone who brings people together, not apart. And I never had a concern about these jurors being fair. I just didn't. I always thought this jury would never ally with the DA because it was their county. I never thought so. I never thought this jury would penalize Michael Jackson because he has long hair, because he has a serious skin condition which I have witnessed. It's called vitiligo. He has shown me his skin. If you look at his back, you will see brown patches and white patches. It's changing and eating pigment in his skin. He's very embarrassed with that. He chose to put white makeup on his face rather than have these splotches all over his face. That's his choice. I don't think it's a crime to do that. And the media kept portraying him as so weird and so strange, and I would say to people, turn on the TV any night and look at people who are stranger than Michael Jackson. He is creative. He dances to his own drummer. On a tape we played to the jury, he said, you know, you like to go to ball games. I like to sit in my tree and make music. Yes, he's different. Yes, he's a musical genius. Yes, he's had his problems. Yes, he's a human being. And no, he's not a criminal. I didn't think he was prosecuted because of his race. I thought he was prosecuted because he was a mega celebrity. I will say this. The last witness I called was actor-comedian Chris Tucker. And Chris Tucker testified that this family who was accusing Michael Jackson had tried to hustle him. They wanted his car. They told him the child had cancer, like Michael Jackson was told. He invited them to a day in Las Vegas where they were filming the film Rush Hour 1. They stayed 3 weeks and billed him for everything. They kept asking him for money, and he flew to Miami, and he met Michael Jackson at a hotel, and he said, be careful, something is wrong. He warned Michael Jackson about this accuser and his family. On cross-examination, the district attorney, Tom Snedden, conducted the cross. And at one point, he showed Chris Tucker a blow-up of a photograph of Chris with the accuser and his family at a wedding. And Chris rather humorously said, I like that picture. You know where I can get it. And everybody kind of chuckled in the courtroom. The DA looked at him and said, I'll get it for you if you're a good boy. Anyone who followed the case knew about the issue of 1108 evidence, which in California is called prior bad acts evidence. And what California allows, and few states do allow, is that in a case like this, you can bring in evidence of other alleged similar acts, even if they were never charged with a crime, and even if they're not the essence of the charge in this particular case. So what they said in their opening statement was, we have evidence that 5 young men were molested, and we're going to present all of that to you. And to make it even worse, it appeared, the judge did something I've never seen happen in a case like this. With respect to 3 of those alleged 5 victims, he allowed witnesses to come in and say they saw them molested without the prosecution having to bring the actual alleged victims in. Okay? So they did that. They put on 3 guards who had worked at Neverland to say they saw these 3 people molested, one of them Macaulay Culkin, okay, the actress, all right? Now, those 3 guards had sued Michael Jackson, claiming that he wrongfully terminated them. He had cross-complained, saying that they had stolen property from him. It was the longest civil trial in the history of Santa Maria. They lost their case. Jackson won his cross-complaint. He had a $1 million judgment against all of them. There were judicial findings of fraud against all of them. They had gone to the tabloids and sold stories, and the 3 people they say they saw molested, they were my first 3 witnesses. They came in and said they were never touched. So when that happens, I think we were able to effectively take hold of us and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you can't believe these prosecutors. You can't believe their case. You know, they'll say anything to try and win. Now, the one you're talking about never showed up. He's the one who got a settlement in the early 90s. Now, my understanding is the prosecutors tried to get him to show up, and he wouldn't. If he had, I had witnesses who were going to come in and say he told them it never happened and that he would never talk to his parents again for what they made him say. And it turned out he had gone into court and gotten legal emancipation from his parents. His mother testified that she hadn't talked to him in 11 years. So, you know, there was a problem there as well. There was a fifth alleged victim who testified, who said that Michael Jackson had been playing with him and had gone too far and touched his testicles, and he needed 5 years of therapy after it. And during the first therapy session, the DA was present. And he also admitted he wanted money from him, and his mother wanted money from Jackson, and his mother went to a tabloid and sold the story as well. So you put all that together, and I submit that it helped us. Because this was a very mean-spirited prosecution. They attacked everything about him, his sexuality, his finances, his music, his attire. They were willing to do anything. And I got to tell you, I heard Dan, whose show I appeared on after the verdicts, and I appeared on not very many of them, but I did appear on his because he's always been very professional and honorable with me. But I heard him mention this idea of pornography. Well, he's correct. They found approximately 90 girly magazines in Michael Jackson's home. Playboy, Hustler, Penthouse. His fingerprints were on them. He had bought them. They never found any kiddie porn on computers or anywhere else. And I used that fact in my closing argument to explain why this guy is not a pedophile. So, a lot of things that the media picked up and gave you a surface impression about were not at all what they were made to seem.
Let's show what behind the back, what you do to the crowds with your daddy in the window.
Okay.
Come on, let's go show everybody.
This is
go shake him up.
Okay.
If you
can
shoot over Michael Jackson so they don't see the baby.
I like that. Conclude that. But you hear what he's saying. We've all heard what Tom Mesereau has to say. But the point is, he's telling truth. He's telling truth, and we're living in a world where people are afraid of all things that are godly. And I'm telling you, I know what I'm saying. I've been told a multitude of times by people on you know, Facebook and even Twitter, you know, that, you know, they really don't like me putting scripture up there because it worries them. It makes them. They think God is going to do something to them. You know, you want to go out and you want to do this, that, and the other, and the Bible says it's wrong. You don't want God in your face. That's as simple as that, you know. You don't want to be there with someone preaching to you. And so that's the way it was. Madonna told a lot of truth. I mean, she brought a lot of truth. Let's listen to her. Madonna, and I'm going to see if we can do something else about that. But, yeah, we lost Madonna. I'm not quite sure what has happened here. I have been having some problems with this station. So we're seeing what can happen. The server has disconnected. So bear with me. You know, bear with me. We're talking right now on the Everlasting Life Christian Radio. Normally, I would have this on A Place in Your Heart because everything I do regarding A Place in Your Heart has to do with Michael. And now, you know, like I'm having a problem with the station. I cannot contact them until Monday. So, therefore, whatever is going on, I hope that it won't be something that continues. So it's just the way it is, I guess. You know, we have to live with those things. And so, yeah. But But Donna had a very wonderful message to share, and I wanted everybody to hear her. We'll get back to Madonna. But again, Michael stood up for everybody, and he went at some point and spoke directly to the people. He just wanted to teach people of love. That's what he wanted to do. But everybody couldn't hear him. It's pretty much like what we heard at the beginning of this, where we heard so many people screaming, or even as Madonna was just trying to talk. So people did not, you know, nobody was listening. They were hearing what they wanted to hear, when they wanted to hear it. And I'm looking at my station, and I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Anyway, though, let's just move on with it, you know. I will move on to the very best of my ability. I don't know what's going on. So Michael talked to everybody. He had people that could hear him and people that could not. And so this is one of my favorite passages in the Bible. This is in Matthew, starting with 13. At this point, you know, the apostles or the disciples have gone to Jesus, and they're like, well, look, you know, why are you talking to them differently? Why are you talking to them like they're babies, talking to them in parables? And so Jesus said, therefore I speak to them in parables, because they seeing see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. And in them is fulfilled the prophecy of Esaias, which saith, by hearing ye shall hear, and shall not understand, and seeing ye shall see, and shall not perceive. For this people's heart is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and should understand with their heart, and should be converted, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For verily I say unto you that many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which ye see, and have not seen them, and to hear those things which you hear, and have not heard them. And that's pretty much what happened. Michael had his Sermon on the Mount also. He had his Sermon on the Mount, if you will. And what I'm trying to see if I can get Madonna back, if you will. I don't know if I will get her back. So anyway, he had to fight to just simply be who he was. He had to fight to be able to talk to us. You know, Jesus talked to the people in parables. Michael came and talked to us in song. He talked to us that way because we would never have been able to understand. We have our lives filled with so much garbage. The things that we hear on at work, the things that people say to us, the things that we are forced to feel, and more than that, the things that we are not allowed to express. I don't say that we should be out expressing everything that's in our mind. I do not believe that. But I believe that there are things that you should be allowed to express because you are a wonderful work of God. And I don't really quite get why it's like that, but it is. It simply is. And so people have to fight to simply be who God has called them to be. I am not sure what's going on. I'm going to see if I can conclude this, because this is kind of making me nervous. I don't even know if anybody can hear me at this rate. So I don't think anybody can hear me. Hmm. dear. I'm shocked. You know, I've been away from the station so long. The station just came back up. And now, you know, I don't know what to say about my show. Now I'm here, and the show has, you know, I'm sure nobody's even listening. But for anyone who is listening, I will do this show again, and we'll probably be a much better show. I want to give a tribute to Michael. I love Michael Jackson. You have no idea. I love Michael Jackson, and I just don't understand why this happened. But anyway, I love you too, and bye-bye.